Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. Today, we're here to discuss episode 7 of one of our favorite period pieces, The Gilded Age. We're excited to track all of the drama between Team New Money and Team Old Money as they fight for power in New York's high society at the end of the 19th century. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul. And for those of you that are joining us for the first time, we're happy to have you. We're cousins who love to explore fantasy and sci-fi stories. Last year, we expanded our coverage to discuss our favorite period pieces. We kicked off that coverage with discussing The Gilded Age, and so we're back to discuss Julian Fellowes' newest project with more in-depth analysis. You can find our episodes on Downton Abbey, Bridgerton, Outlander, and The Crown in your podcast feeds.
We've been enjoying spending every week catching up with the Russells and the Van Ryans and the many rich characters in this show. This week, the Brooklyn Bridge finally opens. We say goodbye to Mr. Forte. Oscar loses the entire Van Ryan fortune. And Peggy gets caught in a lie.
You know, and unlike Oscar, we make it our business to double and triple check, just like your Christmas list, every episode to make sure we have adult content. We don't want you coming out to hang out with us, only to find out that it is an Aurora Fane-inspired farce. Golly. Let's go. Like Jack? I love Jack.
He's the best character. I'm sorry. I don't care. I don't care what happens to everyone else as long as Jack makes alarm clocks forever.
I love it. I just love it. He's like, his clock-making skills were in here, like Jack's clock-making skills. They're the best. He's the best. I'm with you. Yes. All right.
Yeah. Wholesome character. So this week, we're starting with Team New Money. The episode starts with a strategic move by Mrs. Astor. She finally offers the Russells a box in the academy.
You know what? This should have been episode 1. This was the best strategy. This was the best course. What the fuck did she think she was doing?
Throwing her weight around?
Yeah, I guess. It didn't work.
Assuming that Bertha will accept the box, Mrs. Astor later announces this to everyone. Everyone. At Aurora Fane's charity meeting, only to learn that the Russells intend to stay with the Met. Mrs. Astor storms out in disapproval.
Tough.
George Russell is having a really rough week. Mm. After negotiating with the workers to end the strike, he tells his little minion Clay that he's playing the long game. The only problem is that he has not actually outsmarted the workers, as Henderson tells him when he meets with him. The other titans of industry are also really pissed
because he really,
what George did.
He had no fucking, all this shit, all this flexing he's doing in there with Clay, this is all fucking, this is cap, okay? This is straight cap. There's no way, this is like shit he thought about and came up with on the train ride back. He did not think this, like this was not part of his plan. He just is a good dude. Like, let me rephrase that. He is a dude that had a conscience in a moment where he saw his people about to kill people who work for him. And now he's trying to like reframe this like he had some master plan. No, bro. You did not have a master plan. I'm sorry. I just don't agree. I don't believe
Everybody's
it.
Mad at him.
Yeah.
Everybody. Henderson's like, you think you're smart, but we will not be divided.
Yeah.
And the other industrialists are like, dude.
Including
this was like... This was your one job, was to not negotiate with these people.
Yo, Jay Gould is tight, tight. He's super tight.
Flora McNeil shows up at the Russell's house to speak with her father, Watson slash Collier. Yeah. I don't really know what to call him anymore.
Listen.
She tells him she never knew about her husband's plan to have him move to the West Coast. And she wants him to stay in New York, retake his identity as Collier as a retired banker.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
At the Roblin's reception for the opening of the bridge, Larry speaks on behalf of his father, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And tells the guest about Mrs. Roblin's role in the construction of the bridge. She is grateful, but sadly, accurately predicts that her contribution will be forgotten by history.
And I would have been like incensed if you and I both didn't have to Google it and we lived in New York our whole life. Like, you know what I mean? I was like, God dang it, she was right. You know what I mean? Like, it's so wild. Like, it's so crazy. Great stuff over there. And then Team Old Money. It's a heavy episode for the Van Ryans.
After... Yeah, this is a rough one. This is a rough one. This is really... too much happened to them this episode.
It's wild. You know, have a luncheon. Marion does her best to keep up appearances for her engagement. The Reverend Forte collapses during the luncheon and must remain at Agnes's house now. Like, Agnes won't hear of it. No, you're staying here. The doctors tell them that there isn't much time left. So, fully healthy, with a backache, in bed by the end of last episode, and now you're going to die. Oh, my goodness. Peggy invites Marion to speak to a group of educators so that the colored schools can recruit white teachers. It appears to work. After her talk, an Irish teacher says that he can help recruit other white teachers and students as well. Thus begins the integration of the schools in New York City. Meanwhile, Oscar tries to subtly flex. Like, he just walks up on George Russell like, oh, here, a little wave. You didn't want me to marry your daughter? Look, I want to let you know about this investment. Hey, hope it doesn't come between us. Only he finds out that the investment is a scheme.
Oscar. Anyway, continue. We'll talk about it.
It's wild. He, you know, that scene is so, it's like even Mr. Russell's like, okay, have a good day now. cool story, bro. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, man. The business that Maude Beaton introduced Oscar to, it doesn't exist. And Miss Beaton has disappeared without a trace. Not even Aurora Fade, who introduced this whole fucking idea, knows where she is. More on that to come. Peggy attends a rooftop celebration for the bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge, as it's being announced, and reunites with some old friends. It was nice to see her with people that, you know, are part of her community that we never have met yet. Hopefully we get more of this later on in maybe next episode and definitely next season. Over the course of the evening, her mother learns that she lied about how many people were on the trip to Alabama. Despite this, things with her parents are apparently thawing as they watch the fireworks over the newly opened bridge. It's cool. It's good. It was a good scene. I really love seeing that on and I know we'll talk about it more, but I love that whole sequence. Lastly, no one in the Van Ryan household has seen the fireworks. However, as Luke passes away overnight, Oscar arrives in the morning and informs his mother that he has lost most of their fortune in this scheme. Yikes.
I almost feel like we should pour one out for Oscar.
We will do something. Let's take a second. And although we only knew him for like 2 minutes, let's pour one out for the Reverend Mr. Forte. Good dude.
So little,
but good dude. Good dude.
Seems like a genuinely good person. Really sad that this happened to him. Really glad that he had those, you know, moments last few weeks of his life with somebody who he loved.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what a horrible thing for both him and for Aunt Ada.
Yeah. It's rough. Ada finds a little happiness and then it just, you know, up in smoke, you know? It's kind of rough. And, you know, we're making jokes because we're like, man, he's already dead. We barely knew him, this and that. But part of that is because, you know, let's talk about it. The pacing of this episode felt like breakneck speed and a little bit off.
This is the worst episode of the season for me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand what, like, okay. With each passing episode, this opera thing has become even more, like, who cares? Like, I really don't care. Like, the stuff that has been happening the last few weeks is so consequential that I cannot stay engaged in this fight between Bertha and Mrs. Astor. I really don't care. I don't care about Mrs. Winterton / Turner. None of that is interesting to me anymore. And the thing that frustrates me about this episode is you have this triumphant event happening at the same time that this devastating event is happening. And the devastating event, actually, there are two devastating events. The Van Ryans are broke and they just lost the newest member of their family. And there's no time for that to breathe. And then in the background, you also have Marion having to deal with the fact that she does not want to marry Dashiell.
Yeah. At all.
The pacing of this episode was so rough. And I still like the episode, but I just feel like some of this stuff should have been in earlier episodes. Like, why is this all happening at once?
It's just too much at once. And we knew this was going to come because it's the penultimate episode of the season. And they had opened up all these things last episode. And we were talking about there's just so much that happened in that episode. And you got to start wrapping some of those plot lines up. And we knew this was going to be the play. We knew this was going to happen. There was a part of us that knew.
I guess for me, the bridge stuff should have been in episode 5. I just don't care about the bridge. Like, Larry had a standout moment in this episode, and mm-hmm. I feel like you could really lose sight of it.
Yeah, agreed.
So it makes you question what we were doing in earlier in the season. So, like, what a waste of time with the Mrs. Blaine stuff.
Waste of time with the Mrs. Blaine stuff. I stand by, as cool as it is, as much as I understand why their motivations were, we've talked about it ad nauseum. I don't think we need to go down south. I think you could have had the whole school plot line, based on what they've shown us since we've seen that episode, you could have had the whole New York City school plot line without that excursion. The only thing that it served was to have the tension between, you know, Peggy and Mr. Fortune. But you could have found another way to do that too.
Yeah, I totally agree.
That being said, I love the New York City plot line. I love the New York City schools plot line. You know what I mean? Like, that was one that I was like, wow, that I'm happy that they dug into kind of like that part of what we have spoken about numerous times. That there is like kind of, there was enough, you know, discrimination and practices that were against black people in the Northeast. They didn't have to bring in the South, and so I'm glad they really dug into some of that. And also immigrants, as they're showing that even immigrant populations were not getting the things they needed in the communities they lived in. So
yeah, I again enjoy this show. I've really enjoyed this season, but there's some questionable things about the pacing for sure. And I guess I just feel it felt like the opera was going to be the most important thing in the whole season. And now I just don't care. Like, Bertha's been a side character in the last few episodes in a lot of ways. And so I don't know. It just seems like we could have had this sense of urgency around a character death without the other stuff that felt much more trivial.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with it. I mean, the biggest thing that bothers me, I wouldn't say the biggest thing, but one of the biggest things that bothers me is, did nobody check up on Ma Beaton? Nobody thought, yo, let's find out who this lady is. Like, no, she fooled the whole freaking city of Manhattan and all of high society. Nobody knew anything about this lady. Like, and God, I have been saying this from the beginning about this damn Aurora Fane. She is at the center of, like, when Oscar comes to her, like, asking questions and she got no answers, I'm tight. Like, you're the one who set this all off, talking like you knew everything about this lady.
Yeah, it's rough. The whole Maude Beaton thing is rough. It totally makes sense now that she, when Oscar went to pick her up, she was standing outside. Like, there were hints that something was not legit about this woman, but I don't understand why she didn't. How did she do this without getting an introduction?
I mean,
like, when Aurora says she was just one of our numbers, I'm like, that's not how things worked back then.
Yeah.
Like,
Well, it
you don't just walk up to people and introduce. I don't know. I'm sure she figured out how a way around that, but I'm just like, I don't. I guess for me, it's less about the figuring. It's less about Aurora. It's about Oscar not doing his due diligence about a woman he's going to marry. And maybe he should have asked Mr. Winterton how that works out.
I mean, yeah, he should have. He definitely should have. And I'm with you. I put most of this on Oscar and also Oscar's greed and trying to like double down on the investment instead of just taking that first one and rolling. I just humor me in the fact that even Bertha's like rise has come through Aurora Fade and playing two sides to the middle. Okay. She is always in the mix, and now her poor aunt through marriage is destitute because of her mismanagement of the simple things of society. Why is she introducing Oscar Van Ryan to her like, oh yeah, well, it's said that she has money from Jay Gould. Well, can you do some reconnaissance, please? The point is that Aurora Fane is trash. I'm sorry. I love her, but she's trash.
All right. I'm a little more sympathetic to Aurora, but I do think that her always like playing the middle of things, like even when Maud came and asked her about Oscar, she just doesn't have much of a backbone. I don't really know what to say about her. I don't blame her for this. This was Oscar's fault entirely. But
yeah, I mean, it was and it wasn't. It was his fault, but it wasn't his fault. Which he was like, tell me about this is listen, if I come to you and I'm like, tell me about whoever ever, as my cousin, who Oscar is her cousin, you're gonna be like, I don't really know her like that. I mean,
that's legit. You know what that's I mean? Legit. I would be like, listen, I know you need some money, but I don't really know her. I have no idea, like, if any of these stories about who her parent. Also, where did Aurora get the information that she was Jay Gould's kid? That couldn't have come from Maud.
That's what I'm saying. So now we're trafficking in gossip too to like figure this out. This is ridiculous. Like, why are we doing this? And we keep doing this with Aurora. Like, she's Aurora is always. Aurora was the one who was like, he about to propose. Aurora was the one that was sitting up here talking about, girl, I wasn't gonna say this, but I did see Larry leave a little bit early with Mrs. Blaine from the. I mean, like every fucking thing. Aurora's like right there, like, oh yeah, you're right. She is the pot stirrer. She stirs the drink that gets the party going.
I mean, I've been saying, why is Aurora on this show? And I think we know it's so that characters who don't necessarily know each other or wouldn't necessarily speak to each other don't have to, because Aurora just knows everybody. She's like that bridge character between the Russells and the Van Ryns.
Yeah.
And the Astors.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know, man.
But I still, here's why I blame Oscar. He's about to propose to Maud, but he doesn't even know who her guardian is. She never has a chaperone.
Yeah.
He can just go pick her up. And there's no one for her to answer to. Then he does this investment and he doesn't even like quietly ask some questions around town about it. I know that he was sworn to secrecy, but like as a banker, he can start to look into, is this deal even real? Mm-hmm. Like he just didn't do his due diligence. And I know he couldn't just walk up to Mr. Russell and ask him questions before until the deal was done. But there's just so many red flags here that he ignores. And in part because he's also trying to do something sneaky, which is get this woman to marry him so he can have access to her millions, which don't exist.
Yeah. I mean,
but it's like, if you're about to ask Maud, like for her hand in marriage, you just got read for filth in episode one, mm-hmm. for not going to George Russell before going to Gladys. Wouldn't you at the very least find out like who is her guardian, even if she, you know, is a child who was born out of wedlock? Somebody is in charge of taking care of her, of managing her education, of of making sure she has somewhere to stay when she's traveling Europe. How old is Maude Beaton supposed to be? She looks like she's 22 or 23. There's no way a single woman of that age is just tramping around New York City
Even if her mom was dead and Jay Gould was like, she's the illegitimate daughter of Jay Gould, he's still going to make sure that her life is set up in a way where it's far enough away from him and his family, but close enough that he can make sure she's good. It's just going to happen. Like, that's just going to happen. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree. I can't tell. I mean, listen, we're going to talk about later about how she's based on a real character, a real person. So it's not like no one would have fallen for Maude Beaton's stuff, yeah. Right? But I just feel like Oscar missed so many opportunities to get more information and to ask her questions about herself. Like, he would have maybe, if he had spent more time actually talking to her and getting to know her, she would have maybe slipped up and something wouldn't have seemed right.
Also, he's a banker by trade. And you're in making investments. You know what you can do is you can look up the financials and the fundamentals on a company. Even in that time, that's when this all started. You can start looking, okay, what's up with this company? And like, what is this about? Why are these returns so high? And also, if you're a banker and you get a return that doesn't make any sense, this is where it's not Aurora's fault. And they give you a check that's super big. Rule number one, before you reinvest, cash the fucking check. If you would have went to cash the check, it would have bounced and you would have been like, bruh, where's my money? Because I know that you're full of shit.
Totally.
It's kind of wild. He's a bad capitalist. Anyway, this is not a good banker. Not a good banker. So let's talk about Peggy and Mr. Fortune and everything that is happening here.
Do we have to?
I know. It's rough.
I really don't want to.
I know.
I hate this plot. I know. I hate it so much. Peggy deserves so much better than this. Yeah. And I just find this whole thing cringy. Like, Peggy is really trying to, like, distance herself in this episode. And he is not getting the hint. I don't understand where this is going. I just don't get this. No, why are we doing this?
He wants his cake and eat it too. He's getting the hint, and that's why her mom has to check her. Like, yo, I raised you better than this. Like, don't be out here falling for this bullcrap. Like, and he's this is, yes, a little bit on her, but it's like, it's also like he like kind of pushed the issue. You know what I mean? And continues to push the issue, and it's kind of they're trying to dance around it. But it does come off like a little bit like manipulative in the sense that he knows that she really wants this opportunity as a writer. She knows that, you know, there's things that he's using as the carrot and the stick. I don't care what anybody says. And as much as we, you know, this is all a show creation. So obviously we're not going to hold the real person in history accountable kind of in the scene. But that's kind of what's going on. And the character, which is kind of what's dicey about using real people's names when you're going to do this kind of stuff, I think he's being manipulative. And he knows he's married and he should be drawing a firmer line from the beginning.
Yeah, this is her boss. Yeah. I just don't like any of it. And on top of that, I think what we've come to understand in the audience is that this was an accident. Like, I think they had intended this to be a real relationship and then discovered that the real Thomas Fortune was married.
Mm.
Which I'm just like bad research. I don't know how you guys could have not known this.
Well, then how about make Peggy the real Mrs. Fortune? Like, and just like kind of make his real wife in history. That's a cop out to me, because like, you could easily write this where he's not married and Peggy ends up becoming Mrs. Fortune. And that's a...
Here's my theory, though. Here's my theory. They don't want Peggy and Marion to be married yet, because that will fundamentally change their characters in a way that I don't think that the story is ready to go there. They need these single women to be doing unconventional stuff to demonstrate that it is unconventional. We see Peggy's friends from, I'm assuming, from school. Mm-hmm. In this episode, and they're mostly married and have kids, and that really just changes the whole dynamic.
Yeah, I see that.
And so I think the show is unwilling to make Peggy and Marion bad mothers like Mary Crawley and Edith Crawley. Like, I think they're just unwilling to do this thing that shows often do when they have married young characters. Like, this is a ongoing joke of the Mrs. Maisel fans too. Like, Midge is a terrible mom. Hilarious. She like never takes care of her own kids, and so I think this is why they don't actually want her to be married quite yet.
Yeah, I get it.
I get it too, because we already have Bertha. We already have Aurora. We have a number of women who kind of fill that role of like the woman's job is to maintain the house, like the household place in society.
Wait. Is Aurora married?
Of course she is.
Where the fuck? I haven't seen Mr. Fane in like, I don't know, 20 million years. This motherfucker showed up for one conversation this whole season.
Isn't he at the luncheon? He's at the luncheon.
He didn't even come
right?
to the fucking dinner, the opera dinner. Like, she's bringing Dashiell. Like this motherfucker, where is he? He's never around. Never. Anyway, I'm joking, but I had to.
Listen, again, does Bertha have two kids or one?
I don't know. Where is Gladys Russell? Where is she? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think the show wants these two young women who we started the show with to be trailblazers. And I think they're still trying to figure out how that's going to work. Anyway, I don't like this plot. I hate it. I hope it ends soon because I can't take this into next season. I cannot have Peggy become Lady Edith Crawley. I just can't have it.
No, it's
like, just there was a point where there was a real like meme about Edith Crawley on Downton Abbey, and it was like, why won't this show just let Edith be her best self? And I'm getting that energy from Peggy.
I'm super getting that energy, which is upsetting, because a lot of what, same way we talked about, it's such a good connection that you just made, because the same way that we've talked about how he's written gay characters, it's very interesting to think about that Edith, like, she becomes like this publisher and this like newspaper person, but she has all of this like trouble with relationships and her personal life. And it's almost like he's making a subliminal commentary that you can't have both. You know what I mean? You just can't have them. Like, if you're going to be successful as a woman, like, making, like, it's weird, like, that you drew that connection, because I would have never connected those two. But when you made that connection, that's the first thing that pops into my mind.
Well, Lee Edith also had an affair. I mean,
yeah.
He was married and his situation was more complicated. But anyway,
Rough stuff.
I don't want Peggy to be Edith.
Let Peggy be great. Be great, okay? But as part of her greatness, and to be fair, part of Mr. Fortune's greatness, and also part of her family's greatness, was this whole school plot. I thought that it was you know, them getting the insight about what was gonna happen was great. Going and getting into the meeting to kind of like to deal with the issue. History a little bit remixed. You want to talk about what happened there? Like, that's a little bit remixed of what happened.
Yeah, so the schools were integrated. So because they were facing this closure, and this plotline is dealing with just three schools. I think last week I mentioned there were four schools, but one of those schools is in Manhattan. So I believe at the time had a different school board. So they remix this a little bit, but the main thing that's important to take away is that this integration, the Irish students, and it wasn't just Irish, but the white immigrant students and Black students did start to go to school together around this time, which was 17 years before state law required that schools be desegregated in New York. And that comes from, there's actually like not that much like primary resources, sources on this, or even secondary. It's a little muddled because, like I said, there's a schools in Manhattan, and they kind of, history kind of lumps all of the so-called colored schools together. Mm-hmm. But there was a September 2020 article on the Gotham Center for New York City's History's website, and it basically confirmed that this really happened. Like, the schools integrated in Brooklyn. It was in part because of how Brooklyn was developed, and that families started moving into Brooklyn neighborhoods that had been gentrification, basically. Like, gentrification in Brooklyn was happening even back then, and neighborhoods were reshuffling. But rather than open more white schools, white students started to go to the colored schools, and there were black students who started going to schools that had previously been for white students.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is cool. Really,
yeah.
Like,
100%.
I never knew this about Brooklyn, which is kind of dope.
Yeah. No, 100%.
So the issue here that was disturbing to me was just that Arthur Scott asserts this thing, which is like, we need some white folks to tell people.
Got it.
To get the word out for us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so Peggy goes and asks Marianne to do it. And it's true. When this Irish teacher walks up to them at the end and says that he would like to join their ranks, he says he was moved by Miss Brooke.
Got it.
So you have all of these black folks saying, like, our schools are good, our teachers are good, we want to save them, come join us. But Marianne, who is like a first year teacher, if even that, like an amateur at this.
I mean, according to Dashiell, she's not really a teacher. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
I don't want to agree with Dashiell, right? I'm not saying that she's not a teacher. She most certainly is, but like, she's a novice.
Yeah.
And she comes and says, oh yes, the black schools are good, and he's like, ah, the white lady confirmed that. It's just disheartening.
For sure. So let's talk a little bit about the downstairs crews, because there's a lot happening downstairs, and I really want to start with our boy, our guy Jack, who gets into the clockmaking society.
Dope.
Really dope.
Good. So glad.
Yeah.
Love that Bannister has these connections.
Yeah. How so? Like, it's just so we need more. We need more backstory about Bannister. He's like, yeah, let me call my guy.
Yeah, I totally want more backstory about, I said this last week, I think, that Mr. Church and Bannister, I'd love to hear more about their backstory.
Yeah. Me too. I mean, so him getting into the Clockmaking Society, and then what does that mean? I mean, is the patent going to get approved, you think?
I hope so. I just wonder what that means for Jack. I think this is a cool opportunity if the patent is approved and if Jack can be an inventor. It's a cool opportunity for the show, because then you have your working class guy who possibly could become wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to see how the characters around him react to that. Mm-hmm. I think that we would, certainly, like, Mrs. Van Ryan, Agnes Van Ryan, is supportive of Jack trying to better himself. Obviously, she made an investment. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious to see how people will act if Jack is wealthy and tries to enter their society.
And also the challenges, yeah, that he's going to have, like, in that, you know, like, exactly what you're saying. Like, you know, like, he's, I don't know. I think, you know, we've seen a lot of, like, conniving and backstabbing and people maneuvering. And Jack seems like a pretty open and, I mean, not that he's, and just, like, very kind character. And so mm-hmm. having to enter that world where there's all of that going on in business is like an interesting thing. I'm rooting for Jack. I want him to do exactly what he's doing, get his invention patent, like make all the clockmakers have to buy that piece so that they can make their clocks work and just like make a good amount of money. You know what I mean? Super dope. It'd be great.
I would love it. There's, once again, I know people are probably tired of me mentioning Downton, but this is Tom Branson possibilities here.
Yeah.
Let's get it popping. He's a great character.
I love it. And then things are heating up with Mr. Bowden and Mrs. Bruce. Or Miss Bruce.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm all for romance downstairs. So sign me up. I ship it already.
Yeah, me too. I'm with it.
I'm all for it. I mean, as long as it's not a new lady's maid trying to push up on church.
She was all in on church. Church.
Oh, that man. Was too funny. Oh, I man. Still think that was one of the funniest scenes of this whole. She was like, I hope I hear from you.
Oh my gosh. This is so good.
In a job interview, ma'am.
Yeah. The thirst. Oh my gosh. And then what about this? I guess like what's really cool is the other story here is Watson / Collier and his daughter. I guess, you know, we talked about it a little bit, but you know, he'll get to live out. Not only is it cool, like she's like, I don't want you to leave, but it's also cool. He's going to get to just go back to being himself, using his right name and kind of just be part of their life. You know what I mean? It's really cool.
Yeah. I'm so happy for him. Like when he was like, you know, can I see the grandkids? I got a little misty eyed.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm so happy for him. I'm happy for them both. Imagine what it was like for her not to know her dad.
Yeah.
To hear this like disparaging stuff about him. Cause it sounds like she knew that he had fallen on hard times. And then to have that surprise of him being that he'd fallen so far that, you know, he was in service, which for them is like, you know, a real downgrade.
I mean, teaching is a downgrade for them. They're like,
listen,
here, like,
yeah, they're
crazy.
And so it was really moving to see her say, not only do I want you to stay in New York, I want you to be part of our circle and meet our friends and spend time with us. I want to know you as a person. I got really misty.
Yeah.
Like that was,
yeah,
that was beautiful.
It was really beautiful. It was one of the highlights of the season. I love it. Cause that's what I wanted from the beginning. I was like, wait, no, don't let this happen to this guy like this. So especially after he saved the day multiple times. So it's pretty cool. I guess my question is about the downstairs crew before we move on from them is I find it interesting that, and I drew this distinction rewatching a little bit, that a lot of the Russell's downstairs crew is not exactly what they appear to be on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And so, good.
I think this goes back to Turner coaching Bertha on how to move in society. And part of it is, I think, Bertha, who probably was responsible for hiring most of the staff, mm-hmm. didn't do her due diligence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, she wouldn't have hired Watson, right? That would have been her husband mm-hmm. and Bannister. But I also thought it was interesting that she left the hiring of her lady's maid entirely up to Mrs. Bruce and I said Bannister, I meant Church,
yeah.
To Mrs. Bruce and Church. That's also a little strange to me. This is a woman who literally will be in your bedroom, wait first person to you see in the morning, last person you see at night, aside from maybe your spouse. And you would want to at least meet with her before she gets hired.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I'm just wondering also, based on what you just drew that connection to, I'm just wondering if this is like foreshadowing also about this kind of like surface reality that we see the Russells kind of developing. Or like everything is about what it appears to be. Everything is about what it looks like for Bertha. And so like, are they kind of foreshadowing for us that, hey, something's going to come out later that pulls the wool from our eyes and say, oh wow, this they really, maybe something isn't exactly what we think it is about the Russells.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've definitely done a little work this season contrasting George's approach and Bertha's, but I also think Clay is a snake.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think the Russells downstairs and Mr. Clay, who is not part of that, right? He's He's his personal secretary. Something's going to happen, I think, in the future, at least with Clay.
Yeah.
I don't trust this guy. I don't like the way he speaks to his boss. I don't like that. Like, I think something's going to happen with Clay. I think that will be an interesting plot line for sure. But I also think that Bertha's been so focused on the opera stuff that she's not focusing on the stuff that I actually think this is important. And when we're watching it together, my mantra was, where is Gladys? I just think that she's really distracted by this rise in society that she's orchestrated pretty well, but she's missing important pieces. Mm-hmm. Does she even know about Oscar's proposal?
I would think not. I would think that she went, because it sounds like, yeah.
Larry knows. So maybe she does. But it's like, don't you think, in addition to the conversation with George that Gladys had, her mom probably should have also been like, this is how you should handle offers.
100%.
Because we see Agnes giving Marion advice constantly, even though it's unwanted. And it's done in a mean way. Mm-hmm. But someone has to guide these young women through society. And I just don't know if Bertha's been up to the task lately. And if she isn't up to the task, then she needs to get her a better lady's maid.
And also, the thing that she doesn't, in agreement with everything you just said, the other thing that bothers me is that she's angling for, and we've talked about this, for things like in the future, like, you know, like she was put Gladys next to the Duke in at the dinner. She's wanting them to have conversation, but she's not doing any of the work, like not on the surface level. She's not doing any of the work of like, hey, I need to have some private conversations with Gladys to warm her up to the idea of what I see as the best match for her. If you think, in fact, that maybe the Duke or some other man in society is the best match, then, and you have an idea already, you should be having some, what you see Agnes doing, like having these conversations. Look, this is what the benefits are. This is what, and even if it doesn't go over, at least you know that you have done your best to give to make the case. But she's just like making it like Gladys is a chess piece in her rise to society. And that's just wild to me.
Yeah, she's just kind of bullying her in a lot of ways. And I think that some of the, you bring up a good point that, like, in a lot of ways, the Russell household is run on appearances. And so the work that needs to be done to keep up appearances is not necessarily done. Mm-hmm. Like, we see that Oscar fall prey to that this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, there's definitely something that's just, like, not right about how the Russell household is run. And I think last season we knew that because, you know, we had her not even knowing how to do a big dinner, and there's a lot for Bertha to learn.
I mean, putting Maude Beaton on the guest list and not even know who Maude Beaton was and Oscar, like, wasn't there, like, there's like a guest list that was like, this is wild shit. Like, I'm just sorry. Like, I'm like, yo, there's people on these guest lists that, like, you would think that people would do some background on, like, especially in these circles, you know, it's wild. It's crazy to me.
I mean, Mrs. Astor asked for a guest list to every occasion that she's coming to.
Right.
And that should kind of tell you everything you need to know, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. She just has more experience. And I actually have found it a little bit shocking. We haven't seen more of Carrie Astor in this season.
Me too. I think it's wild.
Because I think that it would be interesting to contrast Gladys's being out in society and Carrie's.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe we'll get more. I don't know. Maybe we'll get more in the last episode, or maybe we'll get more next season. Because I think, like, you got to have something with Carrie and her have such a good relationship. It has to be something. So we'll see. And then let's just talk about, I mean, we barely knew him. I mean, this is like one step away from some of the other things that we've referenced in the past. Luke's death. Very sweet, the scenes between them. But damn, this happened fast. You know, like, I really love the conversation between him and Agnes. I thought that it was really sweet and beautiful. And I thought it was...
And it needed to happen.
It did.
We needed to heal.
Yeah, we did.
From Agnes's tirade that she went on just last episode, two episodes ago. I mean, we needed a moment of like...
Yeah.
We needed a moment to show us that Agnes has come around to this marriage, cares about her sister, cares about Luke. That wasn't just her being in charge. Because I think with a character like Agnes, you can get the sense that she just wants to be the boss. Mm-hmm. Like, she just wants everyone to do everything that she says. And I think that is true. I think she enjoys the power of being the matriarch of this family. I'm not disputing that. However, I think that under that, there's also her wanting to do what's right. Like, she doesn't always do what's right, but she wants to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was a powerful character moment for her and for Luke. And I also think it made Luke, I think one of the reasons that he goes is because even though Ada tells him that he can go, he doesn't have to suffer anymore. Like, he needs to know that she's going to be okay. And that's what they talk about, which is basically like, can you take care of her for me? And she's like, of course, she's my little sister.
Yeah.
I got her.
Yeah.
I'm always going to get her.
Yeah.
Which is another reason I think it's all connected. When Oscar does eventually show up and his mother is so furious with him, I think that she's thinking about their responsibility to Ada and to Marion.
Yeah. Agreed.
Which is just like, you may have just bankrupted me, and you made this poor deal, but at the end of the day, you let your entire family down and everyone we're responsible for. We have servants who are not going to have jobs anymore. We have Marion, who's not yet married.
Yeah.
Right. And also, like, we don't know. Dashiell's been talking to Agnes about marrying Marion. She may have settled a sum on her already.
Yeah. Yeah.
She may have said, oh, okay, if you want to marry her, I will settle, I don't know, $5,000 or $10,000. I don't know. I'm just making up numbers. Yeah. On her for her dowry. And if she can no longer provide that, then Dashiell has every right to withdraw from the union. Yeah. I don't think he's that kind of guy. And of course, this is a family connection, but it's a possibility. So this conversation, I think, just reminded us that even though Agnes had some really bad moments this season, that she does actually care and that she is actually responsible for the health and well-being of everyone under her roof.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. No, it's... Oh, Oscar. Good Lord. I mean, I guess we can move on to less consequential things. The opera.
Oh, God.
Will it go away? Will it ever go away?
Is it October yet?
I don't know. It just needs to go away. Like, we just need the opera to happen, man. We only got one episode, so I'm pretty sure it's coming. But, you know, Mrs. Astor is trying to do exactly what George is doing to divide and conquer. And she's, you know, trying to basically say, hey, okay, let me give the most privileged person what they want. And then the other people will be like, yo, we hate you. Why did you do that? Like you were supposed to be with us. But then, you know, and then everything, all the like, oh, we're going to like stand with you, Bertha. It's going to go away. Mrs. Astor and George are failing in this mission. It's not working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It only works if the person that you are trying to buy off doesn't believe in what they're doing. And I think George, I think Bertha and George have, when they talk through this offer, both have good points. One is that absolutely Bertha has to seriously consider this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because if the Met effort fails, that's going to be a huge blow. She can't really afford to take that blow.
Mm-hmm.
And neither can Gladys, quite frankly. No. Like,
no.
It's not just, again, being a matriarch of a family isn't just about the stuff we were talking about a bit ago, which is like running the household, making sure everything goes well. It's also about maintaining the family social standing and caring for everybody under the roof and making sure that their social standing is good. And she can't just be flipping about this, even though George is like, listen, we in this now.
Yeah.
And he's right. He's 100% right. Like, we're in this fight. We can win it. Stay the course. But she's not wrong. She has to consider it. And she has to at least make it appear like she considered it seriously, because she doesn't want, they're frenemies, but she doesn't want an actual enemy in Mrs. Astor.
Yeah, I agree. But Mrs. Astor probably realizing that she was in the losing position kind of makes this move and also presses her advantage. You know, like it goes back to the old saying that I've heard. I often think about when like someone who's been acting real weird all of a sudden is like giving you all kinds of like, hey, you want to do this, and they totally 180. It's everyone who puts you in shit is not your enemy, and everyone who takes you out of it is not your friend. And I think like that's legitimately what she's doing. She's like, hey, okay, cool, let's buddy up, and I'm gonna get you. Like, she's trying to help her get quote unquote get out of the fight. But this is she's already losing. There's no reason for. I think that you're right. She doesn't need to consider it, but there's no reason for her to like actually change course. It's at this point, it's gone too far. She has to win. You know what I mean? Like, she has to win.
Yeah.
You know.
I think that Mrs. Astor thought she had two wins with this, which was the Duke, and then this offer. And I think she thought that her problem was going to go away.
Well, that's because the Duke just showed up with Mrs. Astor to the Roblings reception. He's out here double dipping. He's double dipping.
He's a mess.
Yeah, he is.
He's a total mess. He's just hostess hopping.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm like, speaking of due diligence, someone needs to get on a boat.
Yeah.
And go check out this guy's properties.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'm like, what is going on? I know that he needs money. It's clear that he's in a position where he also has a great deal of responsibility and people depending on him, and he needs funds to keep it all going.
Yeah.
But this behavior is wild. Just going from one hostess in society to the next, he's going to pop into like Aurora Fane's tea next.
That will be
like,
his downfall. That will be the end of him. That'll be the end of his dukedom. Messing with Aurora Fane. She'll have him out here like, what happened? Went to Aurora Fane's party. It was all over for me after that. Tragic words.
She introduced me to a woman named Maud Beaton, and now Maud Beaton owns, you know, my palace at Buckingham.
I don't know. Well, why did you just get with Maude Beaton? Well, she said she was in her party. Like, that. I thought she was. Like, oh my God. So crazy. Speaking of being in someone's party, the unveiling and the party at Mrs. Roebling's, at the Roebling's house for the Brooklyn Bridge. I just love this whole part of the episode. Really shows a couple of things. It shows George's growing respect for Larry and his pursuits of, in like, you know, not only being an architect, but his skills as an engineer. It shows Larry's like perspective on the world and, you know, his courage to say what he, in a room with the president and many other people, to say what he said and in support of Mrs. Roebling. And I just really, really love watching this scene and the storyline and just everything about this part of the season.
I did too. Remember that I wanted him and George to talk about this?
Yeah.
Mrs. Roebling, and to see how George reacted. It's clear that George reacted favorably, mm-hmm. because the Russells are smart about getting what they want. He'd gone to the other trustees and said, can we announce this? They said no. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay, but you're not going to not let my dad speak. So then he went to his dad and said, can I speak on your behalf so that I can give Mrs. Roebling her recognition? And George said, sure. And I think that shows us, I think a lot of the season was about getting to know Larry better. Mm-hmm. And that just shows us his character, that this was so important to him, that he, when he first was told, no, you can't do this, he then decided, but this is important so that this woman's work is acknowledged, and he did it anyway.
Yeah.
I just, Larry's really grown on me this season, even though I hated that foolishness with him and Mrs. Blaine. But this stuff with Mrs. Roebling just kind of shows us that he's very progressive, and I'm hoping it shows us that he's progressive so that we can just finally get what we wanted.
Listen.
Which is him and Marion together.
Sometimes, you know, Mrs. Blaine and I'm hoping Dashiell, maybe they just, well, we already had Mr. Rake. So, I mean, Marion's batting 1,000 here. But let's just get them, let's go. We need these crazy kids to finally figure it out.
Listen, Dashiell could get sick and die next episode. I mean, listen, it doesn't have to be scandal. There could be a lot of reasons why Dashiell exits the picture. Maybe Dashiell's like, yeah, so the whole you suddenly she's going to be poor thing is a no for me. Who knows?
Thanks,
Who
Oscar. Knows? So you mean Oscar helps us out. That's amazing. That would be hilarious. The one thing he's going to get right here. That's awesome. So, I mean, I know, like, we Googled something that is relevant. Speaking of Oscar and his eventual foibles, let's talk about a lady who Maude Beaton may have been based on.
Yeah, so color me surprised when I learned that this really happened. I was stunned. I actually think, and if any listeners remember this, I think that the podcast Criminal did an episode on this woman like 5 years ago. Because when I looked up the story, I was like, oh, actually, this sounds familiar. So there is a woman named Cassie Chadwick. Her real name is Elizabeth Bigley. She was born in 1857 in Eastwood, Ontario, in Canada. And she became the original Anna Delvey. She was an infamous con artist of the late 19th and early 20th century. She adopted various false identities, including claiming to be the illegitimate daughter of one Andrew Carnegie,
wow.
Which I was flattened.
Wow.
Like a Carnegie? Like what? Like what? You're just it kind of reminded me of the dude who claims to be Barack Obama's son.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was just like, what are we doing here? Like pick a B-lister.
This is funny.
So she managed to secure loans and lines of credit from multiple banks and financiers, which is why I'm comparing her to Anna Delvey, because that's what Anna Delvey did too. She lived a like very lavish lifestyle. She had multiple marriages.
Wow.
However, eventually it caught up with her. In 1904, she was arrested for all of her financial deceptions and convicted. She faced a substantial prison sentence, and she was unable to cope and tragically took her life in a prison cell in 1907. Her life and exploits remain notable. Often she comes up when people talk about Bernie Madoff. Like, this was a big con that she ran.
Wow.
And so, while, you know, this is one of the original cons. While I don't think people still know of her name, this is obviously, she was kind of a trailblazer in the criminal world because this was a con no one had really done before. I think she's the first one to do it, at least in America. So that is the life and times of Cassie Chadwick.
So you've got Madoff, you've got Ponzi, and now into the lexicon. Let's not let the patriarchy win. You've been Chadwicked. Whenever somebody
you've been Chadwicked. I agree. I think we got to add her and Anna Delvey into the lexicon for scammers. I mean, this must have been a really horrible con for the people who experienced it, because she allegedly lived like a millionaire. She lived like a very lavish lifestyle and didn't pay her bills, really. So it I'm sure the people who, I'm sure while the history focuses on her defrauding banks, money was not insured by the federal government at this time. So she also could have defrauded families.
Yeah.
Sure. And so it is, we're making jokes about it, but it's a tragic story. And certainly the way that it ends is tragic for her.
For sure. For sure. I just think it's wild that like she was able to pull off, I'm the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. There's like literally only three other people that are as famous as Andrew Carnegie. It's like Vanderbilt, like JP Morgan, and freaking, what's his name? New York, golly, Rockefeller. Like, so like literally we're like talking about like, really? You guys, nobody could do their homework and find out whether she was related to Andrew Carnegie or not. This is wild.
I mean, shit. I think because having children out of wedlock was such a scandal,
yeah,
that it's a hard thing to check up on, right? Because you, if you're moving in these circles, you're not going to bring it up. Yeah. You're not going to ask people, because what if that gets back to, what if it's true and it gets back to Andrew Carnegie?
Yeah, it's true.
Now you've been asking questions about his personal life and spreading scandal around the town. It's a really smart con. And she got caught.
Yeah.
Eventually, because she did it too often. I think she also reused aliases too often, but because of the scandal that society associated with her alleged birth, that's why she was able to pull this con. Having secrets and scandal and shame actually often is worse than if things were just out in the open and accepted.
Yeah. Whew. Well, man, that will do it for the penultimate episode of season 2 of The Gilded Age. We are barreling towards the finale. We just are so appreciative of you listening. Continue to reach out to us through email, kinfolklore@gmail.com, kinfolklorepod on Instagram and on Twitter. And we're so grateful for all of our listeners. And we will see you for the finale next week.
Bye, everyone.